I had agreed to take Brian's class before he had told me where he was. And last Sunday, after the gardens, he told me that he was in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, and I nodded a little bit, okay. And we just finished chapter 1, okay. And I got this look on me, and I think I knew where he was going. And he said, I need you to talk about the man of sin. And some of you might not know what that means as far as the context in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Go ahead and open your Bibles there. And first we are on the side that says 2 Thessalonians 2, 1 through 12, an explanation. The other side is a chart that we'll go through towards the end of the class. Hopefully we will have time because I don't think Brian was planning on giving me two classes, though he gave me plenty of material to do two classes, or three, or four. So as we begin here, I'm going to go ahead and get started. We're going to read a few verses and then we're going to talk about them a bit. But what we're going to try to get to is the crux of the matter. I mean, we're trying to get to the deep-seated issues that are going on here in 2 Thessalonians 2. And what oftentimes happens is we get caught up on showmanship, on elaborate things that don't so much matter. And I'll show you what I mean by that in just a moment. We begin here in chapter 2 and verse 1. He says, "Now, brethren, concerning the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ and our gathering together to Him, we ask you not to be soon shaken in mind or troubled either by spirit or by word or by letter, as if from us, as though the day of Christ had come." So we're going to stop right there a second. So you got this major issue. I know what you guys have been studying here in 1 and 2 Thessalonians. Paul speaks a good deal concerning the second coming of Christ, or perhaps the coming of Christ. And they're wondering about it. We remember back to 1 Thessalonians, it should be chapter 4, where they had concerns over whether those who died before Christ came would still be saved. And if they died before He came, some people were telling them that they wouldn't be saved, in fact, and that they had to concern themselves about that. And Paul says, no, it couldn't be further from the truth. It's just that those individuals will, as you read there, the end of chapter 4, rise first. He goes on to talk about the day of the Lord coming in chapter 5, and then in 2 Thessalonians chapter 1, he talked about the coming of Christ again. And he says, basically here, he says, I want you to know concerning the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ and the gathering together to Him, not to be soon shaken in mind or troubled. So you're concerned about this. You're thinking a lot about it, he says. You're concerned that the coming of Christ maybe has already come, and that's actually what he says at the end, as though the day of Christ had come. And it's in the perfect tense, though in some translations it says, is near at hand, or is at hand. The perfect tense means that it has come to pass, but its effects are continuing. But that is to say that he's come. All right? There we go. But what's happened, if you notice there in the middle of chapter 2 and verse 2, either by spirit or by word or by letter, as if from us. Right? So this doctrine, this teaching has come upon them from people who are not only writing letters and talking about it, but people actually pretending to be Paul himself. People pretending to be apostles, perhaps. People pretending to be people who know what's taken place, and they're bringing this false teaching, and they're trying to get these people overly concerned about it. In verse 3, he says, "Let no one deceive you by any means," which means to say, don't be fooled, right? Don't be fooled, for that day will not come. Notice that. Don't be fooled, for that day will not come unless the falling away comes first and the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition. Now, you can keep going, and we ultimately will because it bears discussing in a scriptural tense. But oftentimes what happens is that this passage gets sensationalized and we lose track of what he's actually saying. And we want to talk about the man of sin, and we want to talk about this son of perdition and the lawless one that will come down in just a little bit. They're all the same name for the same person, or entity, whatever you want to call him. And we want to know about this falling away, right? All of those things. But notice, if you read verse 3 very carefully, they have little to nothing to do with his point. You notice that? He says, I do not want you to be deceived. My main point is that Jesus has not come yet and cannot have come yet. That's his point. It's a very simple point, isn't it? He makes it the very first thing he says there in verse 3. That the day, that day will not come unless the falling away comes first. And the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition. So he's using these as kind of a springboard to deal with these things. Now what you might say is, you might think to yourself in respect to what's going on here. You might say, well, then why does he go on to these things? Because verse 5, he says, do you not remember that when I was still with you, I told you these things? So whatever they know, Paul has already discussed it with them, verse 5, while he was there. And so Paul talked to them the last time about these things. The man of sin, the son of perdition, the falling away, the lawless one. He says, we've already discussed these things. So you should know, because these things haven't happened yet, that Christ hasn't come yet. Now what he's really getting to is the way prophecy works and the way ultimately God works. Because we like to be tantalized, we like scintillating new ideas. So you ask Paul, well, how do you know? Paul's argument, as we keep going, we're at point number 2A right now. Number one, you know God does not lie. That's essentially the basis of his argument. You know that God does not lie. Romans chapter 3. Feel free as we go along, if you have questions or concerns concerning this text. We don't really have a lot of time for extra outside of what we're talking about here text, but you can ask me afterwards if you like. But for now, questions about here are absolutely welcome, and later on, everything else will be welcome. In verse 4, chapter 3 and verse 4, he says, certainly not. Indeed, let God be true, but every man a liar, as it is written, that you may be justified in your works and may overcome when you are judged. Well, that's an interesting way of putting it. He says, if you go back to verse 3, for instance, for what if someone did not believe, will their unbelief make the faithfulness of God without effect? If you have individuals who are unfaithful to God, does that make God unfaithful? No, not in the slightest. He says, certainly not. Right? Even if everyone in the entire world were liars, would that make God a liar? No. No more than it would make me a liar. If everyone else in the world were a liar, does that naturally make me a liar? No. And even more so with God. Hebrews chapter 6, verses 17 through 18. Even more so with God. Because his promises are based on two things. Hebrews chapter 6. In verse 17, he says, thus God determining to show more abundantly to the heirs of promise the immutability of his counsel by confirming it by an oath. Now that word's important, immutability. It's a big word. It just means steadfastness, that it cannot be, nothing gets in the way of it. Right? It's like if, less to the degree that I make a rule in my own house, right? Because sometimes those rules have to change because of situations or whatever the case might be. There are always circumstances that seem to get in the way of if you make a hard and fast rule. But you know who can? God. Because he knows the things that are going on. He knows what's happening. And he says that his promises are immutable, that no one can stand in the way. He's not going to go back on them. And he says that by two immutable things in which it is impossible for God to lie, we might have strong consolation, who have fled for refuge to lay hold of the hope set before us. So here in Hebrews 6, he says it in Titus. He says it as well. There is only one thing, or there is at least one thing, that God is incapable of doing. God cannot lie. And so when he makes promises, when he says things, they are going to come to pass. In fact, Isaiah chapter 40. We're flipping a lot right now, I know. Isaiah chapter 40 and verse 8, page 632 in my Bible. For at least one of you, that matters. Isaiah chapter 40 and verse 8. Something Jesus almost quotes. He comes very close to it. He says, the grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of our God stands forever. Even to the degree that when Jesus is on this earth and he's doing the things of the law, he's living the life in the law, the people think that he's come to destroy the law. That's why the Pharisees kind of hate him for a while. They think he's getting in the way of the law and he's going to change things. That's true. But they think he's going to destroy the law. And he says, do not think that I came to destroy the law. I did not come to destroy it, but to what?
Fulfill
it. Because all of those things had to come to pass in order for him to move on. Let's see. Okay. So, you know one thing more than you know anything else, and that is that God is faithful. That God does not lie. And then you have things like what Paul's talking about here in verse 5. Let's see, 2 Thessalonians 2. I'll read it again, verse 5. He says, do you not remember that when I was with you, I told you these things? So he's talking about how the day of Christ will not come unless the falling away comes first and the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition. These are promises that they have received from an inspired author who has therefore received it from 2 Peter chapter 1, the Holy Spirit. So it's from God that these things are going to come to pass. And you know one thing, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that those things are going to take place. Right? We go to Matthew chapter 24. We're not going to specifically go there yet. We will go there in a few minutes. Jesus preaching concerning the destruction of Jerusalem. Which as far as Jesus is speaking in approximately 32 to 34, depending on how you sway the calendar, isn't that big of a concern. He's speaking in approximately, 37 years before it happens. 37 years after he dies, the temple is destroyed. And yet, you know, and so did those Christians there who understood what he was saying, they knew that was going to happen. They knew it was going to take place. And as we go through the book of Revelation, we know, even though it's written way after Jesus writes, it's written pretty much between, 85 and as late as 96 AD, if that helps. We know that the things that he is talking about are going to take place, which means that Jesus cannot return in the way we think of it. He cannot come and take back the saints. He can't come in the way that is described there in 2 Peter chapter 3. That is the destruction of the earth by fire. That cannot happen until the things that have been prophesied get fulfilled, come to pass. And that's exactly what Paul is saying. So it's less important. We get so caught up on the things that are less important. It's not as important what these things specifically are talking about. It's more important what he's specifically saying to these Christians there in Thessalonica. To the Thessalonians, he is saying, no, Jesus hasn't come yet in the way that you are asking. And that's it. And the next seven verses are to elaborate further on what he means by those things. But the crux of the matter is right there. Jesus has not come yet. He could not have come yet. For whatever these things mean, they have not come to pass yet. And until they do, the possibility of Christ's coming is not even available. The chances of him coming are zero until those things come.
Revelation chapter 1 says that every eye will see him.
Even they that pierced him. Yep. So, questions about that? I didn't think so. This next part, we'll see. All right, so moving beyond just what exactly he is talking about and the scintillating and tantalizing things that people are concerned, overly concerned about, we got to the bread and butter, right? So you get the basis of the point that Paul is making as of 53 to 54 AD, because that's about when this was written. I don't know when Brian said it was, but that's, as my approximation goes, you could label it anywhere from 49, I think, to up to 62, but you're still nowhere close to anything huge happening yet. All right, so in verse 3, 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, one more time, questions. All right. Verse 3, he says, let no one deceive you by any means, for that day will not come unless the falling away comes first, and the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition. Now, we're going to deal with these one at a time, even though the second two are technically one thing, and it goes on from there. He says, unless the falling away comes first, and sometimes what we do is we connect it then to the next two as well. And then we supply the son of perdition and the man of sin. That's not what it says. This cannot happen until until the falling away comes first, right? That's the clause. That's the phrase. And you've got to stop there for a second because that's all it's talking about. That's not to say that the falling away will come before necessarily the man of sin comes or the son of perdition comes. It just means that these three things have to come before Christ can come. Okay? Okay. So the man of sin or the falling away will come first. And then he doesn't elaborate on what that means. Not a single verse after this is talking about the falling away. So he just kind of leaves you there. But he doesn't really, because in 1 Timothy chapter 4, so remember, we're not talking about the man of sin yet, or the son of perdition, we're talking about the falling away. In 1 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 1 he says, "Now the Spirit expressly says that in latter times some will depart from the faith, giving heed to deceiving spirits and doctrines of demons, speaking lies and hypocrisy, having their own conscience seared with a hot iron, forbidding to marry and commanding to abstain from foods which God created to be received with thanksgiving by those who believe and know the truth." Now, our first instinct when we see, especially there in verse 3, forbidding to marry, our first instinct is to go, "Oh, it's the Catholic Church." This is probably not the Catholic Church. In fact, something fits way better in this, and that would be incipient Gnosticism that's taking place here. I've talked about Gnosticism before, but basically the Gnostic doctrine is that flesh is inherently evil and spirit is inherently good, and they cannot mix. And so you get really degrees of Gnosticism, you've heard of them, people who whip their backs. Right? That's a basic doctrine of Gnosticism. You beat the flesh to release the spirit is the idea. It's really disturbing, and it's exactly opposite of what Paul is teaching here, but they also taught against marriage and eating a number of different foods. Anything you could do to deprive your body physically was a good thing spiritually.
Pole setters.
What's that?
Excuse me, the pole setters.
The what?
Pole setters.
Pole setters. I don't know.
Who would create long towers and sit on a platform up there to punish themselves and weather the treatment.
Yes. That you have individuals even today who want to get kind of a closer view of Jesus, and so you have these I know it's happened in Mexico a few times where individuals have chosen to be crucified, and though they don't go all the way with nails and everything, they have themselves strapped to a cross and they hang there for the number of hours that they possibly can, and then they give up when they do not have any more endurance. It's the same basic principle. Thinking that berating your flesh is going to get in the way of, or is going to help your spirituality. But ultimately what we're looking at here in 1 Timothy 4 is that he says there, especially in verse 1, he says, let's see. Yeah, now the Spirit expressly says, right, so he's got word from the Holy Spirit, it says that in latter times some will depart from the faith. And he goes on to elaborate on that and what exactly it will mean, which would be potentially Gnosticism here. But he says that's something that's going to happen in the future. Right? So he's predicting things that are going on, a falling away, in fact. In Acts chapter 20, verses 28 through 31, if you remember back to Paul's days, finishing his third missionary journey, he comes back and he wants to talk to a group of people, the elders of Ephesus. He's in Miletus. In verse 28, he says, "Therefore take heed to yourselves and to all the flock among which the Holy Spirit has made you overseers to shepherd the church of God, which he purchased with his own blood. For I know this, that after my departure, savage wolves will come in among you, not sparing the flock. Also from among yourselves, men will rise up, speak perverse things to draw away the disciples after themselves. Therefore watch and remember that for 3 years I did not cease to warn everyone night and day with tears." Another prediction. A prediction, and you don't know, it's not clear whether he means when he says, after my departure, whether he means when I leave Malta, because he's on his way to be imprisoned. He's going to begin his prison ministry. Not exactly what we mean today by prison ministry. He literally means in prison ministry. But he's going to begin his prison ministry. But that's not to say he can't still write letters, and does still write many letters from prison. It could also mean he's talking about his death. After he dies, people are going to come here to Ephesus, or technically they're in Malta right now. So he's like, they're going to come to your hometown in Ephesus, and they're going to feel able to say things that they wouldn't while I was alive and could write about it, or while I was there, literally. Whatever the case might be, he is predicting things to go poorly after he dies, which seems to be a huge concept in the New Testament as they're looking forward to the days, potentially, that the apostles die. I mean, at that point, you remember in Acts 15, when there was a disagreement over circumcision, Paul and Barnabas are out preaching the Word of God, and they had issues with circumcision, that the Jews wanted Christians to be Gentiles to be circumcised in order to get into Christ. And they said no. And so the disagreement became so heated that they went ahead and sent them back. Do you remember who they sent them back to? The elders of the city where they were in. He sent them back to Jerusalem to talk to a group of people.
The apostles.
The apostles, right? And then you have what's called the Jerusalem Council there in Acts 15. And so they were authority figures when it came to scriptural matters, even though Paul, an apostle, technically, Barnabas is called one as well, which I always wondered about what that exactly meant. Regardless, you've got one apostle being questioned by everyone else, and he goes ahead and he says, fine, we'll go back to Jerusalem. I know what they're going to tell us, but I'll go ahead and let everyone go, and we'll discuss it there. And so they discuss it at length, and they come to a decision according to the Scriptures. But what happens after the days of the apostles? What happens after the days of the apostles? You have no more authority figures to go back and ask outside of what letters you possess until about 350? This is the Council of Nicaea when the letters were brought together and it was finally established which books belonged and didn't. So for about, 250 years, there's no apostles to go back to and go, hey, and grab, you know, a shirt coat and, I got a question. Hey, can I ask you something? Hey, can you give me some divine revelation from God here? Because I really got a problem. And so there's a big opportunity to fall away as well. And that seems to be what Paul is predicting anyway. 2 Timothy chapter 4, the time will come when they will not endure sound teachings, but will heap up for themselves teachers, right? It's not right now because who's there? Paul, right? He's not there in Ephesus technically. That's where Timothy is. But as he's writing, he is capable of continuing to write him until he dies, he departs. So until he dies, he's going to be there in the spirit anyway. Basically, what it's describing, this falling away, is a mass exodus from the church for whatever reason. And it could be for anything. And we're not told what exactly he was talking about here. But we do know that many of them happen, as we will look at in just a second. And it could be for persecution, as far as the reigns of the Roman emperors took place. Many Christians, or I should say Christians, walked away from the church because it was too difficult to stay in it. The ones who did stay in either found ways of staying Christians and maybe dealing in the black markets, Christian black markets, not like unwholesome black markets, but they had Christian black markets because they couldn't buy and sell in the marketplace unless they had gone to the temple and worshipped the God according to Domitian, there we go, and the other emperors after him anyway. But it could be because of wickedness, which is described here in Acts 20. He says, there are some who are within your group of people, literally, right? I mean, did you hear that? He says, there are going to be wolves that come from without, but there are going to be people from within who are going to rise up, which means they're among you right now. And you don't even know that they're problems, that they're going to become problems. And so there's a huge potential wherever it's coming from. In 1 John chapter 2. In verse 18. So Paul writes from about, let me see. He writes from about what, 45? His earliest letters, if my memory serves me, which is kind of hokey when it comes to dating. That sounds weird. So 45, I know, right? I'm all hyped up. I've been so excited. I spent the last 3 days working on this. So anyway, now let's keep going. 45 to approximately 56, 58. And so he spends that amount of time writing letters potentially, right, to various churches, congregations, before he either is released or dies at the end of 2 Timothy. No one's really sure. According to tradition, he dies. But notice the things that he says. And I wrote them down there for you. 1 Timothy 4, Acts 20, 2 Timothy 4, he says, in latter times, after my departure, the time will come, right? He's predicting He's predicting a future something. But if you pick up here in 1 John chapter 2, John writes, it's believed that this book is potentially written after Revelation or just slightly before he gets imprisoned on the island of Patmos. There we go. Anyway, but 1 John chapter 2 in verse 18, he says, "Little children, it is the last hour." The last hour. "And as you have heard that the Antichrist," and that word "the," if you have it in your text, "is supplied." The word doesn't have a direct or a, what's it called? A definite article adjective, which is to say, it doesn't have "the." Technically, it should be "a." He says, not "a Antichrist," that would sound weird. He says that an Antichrist is coming even now. "Many Antichrists have come, by which we know that it is the last hour." Remember what Paul said? That all these people are going to rise up, that all of these things are going to transpire. Well, guess what John just said? He says it's happening right now. Right? That's how we know it's the last hour. "They went out from us, but they were not of us. For if they had been of us, they would have continued with us, but they went out that they might be made manifest that none of them were of us." So, basically, John here says the very thing that Paul had just said to the elders, not just, like 30 years earlier, to the elders in Miletus. Right? Remember what he said? They're going to come from without, and they're going to rise up from within. And he just said that they're going to be, they were among us, but they weren't really among us because they weren't with us. If they were among us, if they were part of the church, they would have remained with us and they wouldn't have walked away and manifested themselves as Antichrist, which means against Christ. So he basically says, and I think it's interesting anyway, he says, this is the last hour, but Paul has continually said, the hour has not come yet, right? He's looking forward to an hour that's about to approach, that's coming, and John says, the hour, this is the last hour, right? Does that make sense? I'm getting a shady look from one of you. Not a shady look. I mean like shaded look. Like I'm not so sure what you're saying. Okay, so I will elaborate slightly. Basically what you have is Paul writing at the outmost, if I'm, maybe you can enlighten me here. The outmost I think Paul writes is about 58 AD. Is that at least rough? Yeah. Roughly right? Okay. So 58 AD is where Paul stops. He doesn't know anything, or doesn't at least write anything that we have after that. So we don't know what he has to say after that. We don't even know if he's alive after that. So 58 is about when he stops, and I need to do this backwards for you guys. It's backwards for me. It's forward for you. So 58 is here, and I'm going forward in time now. And the book of Revelation and ultimately John's writings take place about, what, 88, potentially 84 to 92, even potentially as late as 100, if he's a really old guy. So you got 40-50 years here for things to be happening. Paul, he says, things are going to happen, right? He's looking forward to things. John says, it's the last hour now, right? And we know that because the Antichrist, the people that we perceive anyway, have been talked about all this time by Paul and other apostles. They're here, right? They're in our midst. They're doing things. They're active. They're, right? They're involved in their unrighteous works. Does that make sense? Okay. So it seems like whatever he's talking about as far as the falling away, potentially, it seems like the clues lead us to believe that it happened from between, say, 58 and, say, 90 to 100. Okay? That doesn't mean that's specifically what he's talking about, but it seems that way anyway. That's as best as I can give you. I'm sorry I can't give you more. The problem is, we weren't involved in verse 5 of 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Where he says, you should know because last time I was with you, what? I talked with you about these things. You ever listen to half a telephone call? Drives you crazy because you don't know what's happening on the other line. And unless the person is really odd and repeats everything the other person says, no one does that. You don't know what the other person is saying at all. But it's even worse than that because we're missing not only their half of the conversation that's going on right now, we're also, they're talking about a conversation they had in the past that they had and you have no idea what they were talking about. So, needless to say, the Thessalonians know what he's talking about and ultimately we can speculate, but we don't. We don't know what he's talking about. You look like you want to say something.
No, I'm thinking that they do know what they're talking about.
Oh, the Thessalonians?
Yes.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. And that's the thing Paul said there. You should know this because we talked about it, right? I mean, how many times do you tell your kids? I've told you once, I've told you 1,000 times. And Paul's kind of like that with the disciples that he writes to, isn't he? Okay, so we go on from the falling away. It seems like it took place sometime before 100 AD anyway. And then what takes place afterwards, and we have not enough time for this, and I don't know who's supposed to check on the classes, but I think it's time to do so. Or at least it will be in about 25 seconds. Very time-sensitive kind of guy. Not really. Oh, Bob's here. Dude, Bob. Sorry, Bob. I overlooked you there. My bad. Okay. And we're going to skip down to 4 number 2, I guess. Erase that 1. Whatever. If the man of sin has come and the falling away, then has Christ already come? This is a good question. Because in, let's see, let's go to 2 Thessalonians 2, that's 1 Thessalonians, 2 Thessalonians 2, in verse 8 it says, "And then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will consume with the breath of His mouth and destroy with the brightness of His coming." And so many people speculate from this passage that by that he means when Jesus comes in the way we think of, right? Ultimately, in final judgment, taking the saints with Him and destroying the earth. That in that time, that man of sin or that lawless one will be done away with. And that will mean, if that's already happened, then Jesus has already come. Major problem with that is that the word coming or Christ coming is used numerous times in the New Testament and doesn't always have to do with the coming that we think of. In Matthew chapter 24, he uses the term, the Son of Man coming in the clouds, as the emperor, Vespasian, approaching the city of Jerusalem and being the judgment of God upon the city of Jerusalem. Jesus didn't literally come to the city, but Jesus, in a metaphoric quality through Vespasian, technically Titus, came to the city and destroyed it. It was God's judgment that was coming upon the nation. You also see that through the Old Testament when he talks about the day of the Lord. Most of the time the Jews think of the day of the Lord as the end all of days. We've talked about this numerous times. It's the end of days, it's the end all of days where the Jews will be exalted and all of God's enemies, ultimately the Jews' enemies, will be put under their foot and they'll stomp on them and have fun and dance on their grave. But that's not the case at all in the Old Testament. In fact, the day of the Lord takes place numerous times. Because the day of the Lord is an idea. The day of the Lord is an idea concerning the judgment of God upon specific individuals, specific nations, or ultimately, yes, all people all together for the end of time. But the same is used in context here. And so when we go into, say, Matthew 24, we're going to see a number of these things. But what I'm going to do today is that the thing you're talking about, you, when you say Jesus coming, you think the second coming, you think the end all days, you think the day that Jesus is going to take the saints up and he's going to destroy the world in fire. Well, in 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 10, it says, "But the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with a great noise and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Both the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up." And I'm going to use Paul's argument here. And I'm going to look around. And I think you understand the conclusion I'm coming to. Jesus hasn't come in the way that you're thinking yet. Because if he had, there wouldn't be anything here. Right? We'd be living in a spiritual realm, hopefully all of us on the right side of that spiritual realm, and I wouldn't be able to touch this chair. You ever do that? Like, you pinch yourself? I don't pinch myself when I try to decide whether I'm awake or not. I usually pinch someone else. Which doesn't really help me any, but I'm always like, it's a good excuse to pinch people. At least I think so. Does that make sense? Not the pinching people. 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 10, right? Using the same argument that Paul used. The very same argument. Right? So, the stuff's still here. The elements are still together. Earth hasn't been burned up and destroyed. Christ hasn't come yet, at least in the way we're talking. Now, Christ has come in numerous ways. For instance, to Saul of Tarsus. I mean, what is it that approached him on the road to Damascus if not Jesus? So Jesus came in a particular way, just not in the way that we think of when we talk about Jesus coming. And Jesus himself in Matthew 24, as I said just a second ago, talks and uses his own imagery to talk about the judgment that's coming on ultimately Jerusalem. So, questions. All right. Now the question you should be asking, and I'm considering leaving for Brian, is who's the man of sin? That should be fun. So turn over your page. There are numerous, and when I say numerous, I mean an unseemly number of options when you're talking about the man of sin. Okay? There are two potentially directly from the scriptures, and by that I mean they could fit the bill. There is a third that seems fairly likely and is held by numerous members of the Brotherhood. That would be the Catholic Church. And there are untold thousands more that various theologians and scholars and hedge shrinkers and all kinds of people like that have in mind. The two most common are the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, which would be Titus coming to town and Jesus warning the people about the destruction of the city of Jerusalem and that they needed to skip town when they saw it. And when they saw it, they all skipped town. All the Christians left, and not a Christian was killed, according to historical accounts, in the destruction of Jerusalem, though they should have been if they hadn't been warned. And so I left you with a number of... And if it doesn't make sense, it's because I didn't put columns in it. It's in Word. I couldn't figure out what I was doing. I don't know how to work Word. Anyway, the one on... Let's see, this would be the left. There we go. The very left is the man of sin, son of perdition, the lawless one, which is ultimately those verses that we're pertaining to, verses 3 through 10. They all have to do with basically the same thing. And these, under it, from verse 4, obviously oppresses God, opposes God, not oppresses, exalts himself above God, sits as God in the temple. I can't read upside down right now. Those things follow sideways, right? It's built like a chart. So you can just track it sideways and you can see where things add up, where they don't. And for especially the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet there in Matthew 24, I have a question mark here. At consumed with the breath of his mouth, I have no idea how that fits. I can't tell you. And then according to the work of Satan, no idea. I also left some blank because there could be ways of looking at it and there could be ways of looking at it differently. I obviously, if you want to know, I obviously think that it's Domitian, the eighth horn from Revelation 13, 17, 19, and Daniel 7, or 6, 7, 6, I don't remember. And you can see why in my column here. And I left you a space, so you can put your thought in here, because it's practically as legitimate as mine, because we obviously don't know what in the world the man of sin is, at least as far as I can tell. And some people think it's the Pope. And you can put a little check mark, because you can't find Bible verses that support that view. And I don't mean that in an arrogant, aggravating way. I just mean that there's no prophecies concerning the Pope, but he might fit the bill. Right? So anyway, if you have questions about this, let me know. And if you have really, really, really strange questions, ask Brian. So anyway... if he listens to this, Brian, if you're listening to this, I don't know if he's going to want me to finish the study here of the man of sin or not. If we do, we can go through it and look at it, or Brian can, and he can try to figure out what I'm talking about, which is going to be brilliant, and I'm going to record it. But anyway, because sometimes I don't even know what I'm talking about. So anyway, thank you all very much for your time. If you have any questions, feel free to ask. Not only things about this study here, but ultimately anything, whatever.